Well, good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, and it's great that you've all ventured out of doors on a rather wet Thursday night. We're pleased to be able to present and offer an ongoing series of diverse events with authors, scholars, performers, and many types of entertainers. For a list of our upcoming events, you can pick up a copy of the events newsletter, though I learned just a half an hour ago that they're actually all gone downstairs. So your other option is to, if you have email, join the e-list. There's cards outside, and with this you will start to get monthly updates from the library and email blasts, as they say, about library events in this room. As we begin, may I ask all of you who might have cell phones or pagers to please silence them. We do record these events and broadcast them on the internet forever. The Society Library really does rely on the support of our donors to make evenings like this possible. Right now, our annual appeal is in full swing, and in 2009, as you can imagine, more than ever, the funds raised are really crucial to helping the library maintain its collections, to provide programs, and to keep the staff in the building. On behalf of the board and the staff, thank you so much for your support. We do have books for sale, and I understand that Ms. Gillies will be willing to sign them after the event. It really is my pleasure to introduce one of the Society Library's member writers. Ms. Gillies, as many of you may know, is a native New Yorker and is known as an actress in film and television. For those of you who have watched Law & Order Special Victims Unit over the years, you will recognize Isabel as Kathy Stabler. But we're here tonight for her first book, and it's a very, very good book. When I was thinking earlier what to call it, I used the word story, but it's a lot more than a story. This is very much a book that's a personal journey. Clearly, Ms. Gillies has struck something that is a universal experience. This is really more than a story that's just about marriage, children, family, and the big D, divorce. This is a book that is really about strength, about survival, and I would say also about a life that's fully lived. I'm pleased to know that Ms. Gillies is actually writing the follow-up to her book Happens Every Day, and she'll be hoping to publish that in the next couple of years, I believe. So please join me in welcoming Isabel Gillies.
Hi, thank you, Mark and Sarah and everybody at the library. It truly is such a marvelous place, and I wrote this here, and the second one too. And it is just such a pleasure to go up to the fifth floor and plug in and see everybody. And so, if you're not a member, then do become one because it's just such an awesome place. So anyway, thank you for having me, and thank you for coming in this piggy weather, which it truly is. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read a couple of chapters, and then if you have any questions or anything you want to discuss or ask or anything, just throw it out. And that's what's been really fun about these things is the discussions. So if you do have anything you want to talk about or writing or divorce or flowers, you know. So I'm just going to read three chapters. And my husband always tells me to say, these three chapters have a lot of explicit language in them for some reason. The whole book doesn't, but these do, so don't be shocked. Or be shocked, but I apologize. Chapter 28. In the movies, when husbands or wives suddenly announce that they are leaving a marriage, life seems to stop and suddenly make room for the utter shitstorm that follows. The jilted woman or man has endless time to wallow in bed for days, crying or drinking. That actress never gets out of her nightgown except to take long, meaningful walks through Central Park. I needed to be in that movie. In my real life in Ohio, absolutely nothing stopped. The mailman kept coming. I needed to go to work. The children still had to be taken to school and fed and washed and played with and loved. You were still invited to dinner parties. The phone rang off the hook. The laundry still spilled out of the hamper. If anything, your life became much, much, much busier because suddenly you had to deal with at least 50 family members and friends frantically trying to find out what happened and talk about what a disaster it all is. The circling wagons and campfires were inevitable and helpful, but they were time-consuming, especially for someone who didn't have a nanny. Running that house was no small feat. It had 2 floors, 4 bedrooms, a library, living room, dining room, kitchen, basement, and 4 porches. We had put in new appliances, a heating system, and electricity, but the house was 120 years old. It had its issues, and it had 4 people in there and 3 animals living in it. Being that it was fall, every leaf on every one of our gargantuan old trees was about to drift onto the lawns that surrounded the house. That was another thing I didn't get about living in the suburbs. There are lawns. Lawns need to be cut, not once a month, but once a week. And raking the thousands of leaves is grueling work that doesn't stop until it snows. And that's another nightmare that I won't even get into now, but thanks snow shovels. I suppose that when your husband decides to leave, you and your 2 children, everyone understands why your house turns into a shithole and your children walk around in dirty pajamas for 3 months. No one would expect you to produce a meal or hang a picture. You are given a free pass to be a mess in every way, but I didn't want that pass. Maybe it's because I'm my mother's daughter and a stiff upper lip is the way my parents deal with disaster. Or maybe I was just denying everything. But I was not going to let my beautiful house fall apart or my children miss a birthday party because my marriage was circling the drain. Maybe I should have. Maybe I should have just given in and let it all hang out. But how could I? There were beds to be made and art drawers to organize. I'd never been so busy in my life. Whether it was a bat in the attic or a conked out light bulb in the library, there was always something to clean or fix or deal with. It felt futile because in the back of my mind I knew very well that Josiah not wanting our life meant that we would have to sell that house. But I loved it. It gave me the greatest pleasure to oil the oak banister or put pots of mums on either side of the front door. It was a real home, and I wanted to treat it like one no matter what was going on. Chapter 29. Our family and house life didn't jive with the husband having his own life thing. The two realities kept smashing into each other. There was a dinner at the Environmental Building honoring Josiah's old advisor from Harvard, Helen Vendler, the poetry scholar. She is an academic giant and gave a series of lectures at Oberlin over the course of a week in October. "So, I guess I'm not going tonight, huh?" I said to Josiah, who was making a peanut butter sandwich to eat at the office for lunch. Breakfast time was beginning to be one of the few times we saw each other. "I guess not," he said quietly, carefully wrapping his sandwich in wax paper. I think he ate 400 peanut butter sandwiches in the time I was married to him. It was really awkward that we were having this conversation. Not a month before, he had told me to get a babysitter for the evening. It was a big deal that Helen was in town. He respected this woman the way the chief of staff respects the president. I had never met her. Although we had spoken on the phone many times, she gave both boys framed poems when they were born. It felt like the entire town was going to go to this thing except for me. Certainly the entire English department would be there. I thought that it would stand out that I wasn't there, and that felt embarrassing. It was at those kind of events that I would feel the most proud of Josiah. It's cool to see your husband in his element, and dinner parties for poetry scholars were really his element. And the thing was, most of the other English professors looked like what you would imagine, scruffy, thinning hair, awkward. But Josiah looked like the captain of the lacrosse team, or a male model. People did confuse him for a male model. It was just funny that Josiah was so good looking and such a nerdy English geek all at once. It was like Indiana Jones. I always imagined that his students, male and female, might write "I love you" on their eyelids and bat them at him during his class. Josiah went to the dinner by himself, and while the boys slept, I ate takeout Chinese food and watched horrifyingly stupid reality shows on MTV that at the time I found fascinating. Reality TV, Katrina, Angelina Jolie's relationship with the married Brad Pitt. The lady on E! kept saying things like, "Representatives from both stars categorically deny the rumors." I would yell at the TV, "Bullshit, of course they're in love." I never thought that I would feel such a strong bond with Jennifer Aniston. I just settled into one of those shows when I heard a gushing sound from the kitchen. I ran in there, and there was a geyser of dishwashing water spouting from the dishwasher. Dishwashing water spouting from the dishwasher, which I just turned on. As the water started to get out of control all over our new Brazilian almond floors, it dawned on me that I lived in a house in the country that I owned. There was no super downstairs to come to my rescue. I had zero idea of what to do and scooped up the dog so that she didn't drink any of the soapy water. Panicking, I pushed every button on the machine to get it to stop, which it didn't. Fuck, 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 I thought. The boys were sleeping, I was sure of that, and the environmental building was just down the road. I ditched Plover and took off out the side door. I left the boys alone with the waters rising. What if the water caused an electrical fire? What if they woke up and went downstairs and drowned because the water had risen so high? What if they woke up and no one was there? Why the fuck was Josiah at a dinner without me? Why do we live in a house with no super downstairs to call? Why is our brand new dishwasher broken? The dinner was being given on the first floor of the building, which is made entirely of glass. Solar energy, get it? As I booked up the street in my moccasin slippers, I could see the English department and all of the college elders and special guests seated around tables with maroon tablecloths. I searched for Josiah. Maybe he would see me through the window and I could signal to him for him to come. But truthfully, I wanted to make the splashy, desperate entrance that the situation deserved, so he and everybody we knew could see that leaving a wife alone with children in a big house wasn't a good idea. By that point, I had told some people that we were having troubles in our marriage. It's a terrible thing to have to admit to and causes the life in a fishbowl thing to go into high gear. I opened the huge glass door, causing everyone to look over. My hysteria must have shown on the outside, too, or maybe people just felt sorry for me from what they were hearing through the grapevine, because I got lots of looks as if I were a dog in the pound that nobody was adopting. I searched the room for Josiah and saw him sitting at a table next to Sylvia. He was deep in conversation with her, as usual. "Josiah!" I gasped and gave Sylvia a death glare. "What happened?" he said, worried it might be the boys. "The fucking dishwasher is exploding and the boys are alone in the house. You have to come home," I said, and gave Sylvia another pointed look. "See? I'm the wife with the kids and dishwasher. I'm the wife. He went with me. We both ran down the middle of the road home. "Why is it every time I see you, you are sitting next to Sylvia?" I said while running. "Oh, Jesus, Isabel, can we focus on the matter at hand?" he said, and ran ahead of me to turn off the dishwasher. He could always find the button I couldn't find. Chapter 30. Unlike lots of men, Josiah didn't prolong the task of severing himself from me romantically. From that Sunday in our library on, he never wavered in his conviction that he could not be in the marriage anymore. He never held my hand again, never touched me by accident as he rounded a corner in the kitchen, never gave me a wink, bought me a flower, called me a nickname. He never kissed me again. He never made love to me again. He never even looked at me lovingly again. Sometimes he would look at me in a worried way, and then he would look away. He didn't want to be hurting me so badly, but he couldn't stop whatever had taken hold of him. I was out. It was just so shocking to have all this happen in such a short amount of time, but it made things extremely clear. Even the day before the library day, I couldn't see him differently than I saw him myself. We were all muddled up in each other, attached, entwined. I had no perspective looking at him, no objectivity. But now he had demanded a distance, and from that distance I could see his behavior very clearly. I could also see his behavior up close and personal because we were living together. In one day, I went from living with my partner doing husbandy things to living with a teenager who was head over heels in love, but not with me. I can tell when someone is in love, even a stranger. It must be that first flush of love gives off a pheromone or smell. It's in their smile, the way they breathe. People don't eat when they're in love, but people don't eat when they're divorcing either, so I don't know what that means. Love changes chemistry, and you can just tell when it's happening, especially to your husband. The maddening and absurdly confusing part was that he was denying it. This is when I went into detective mode. He had brought most of his things to the office, so I searched for clues in his behavior. It was also the time when I ceased to sleep. In driving school, they teach you about total stopping distance time. You just can't stop a car short. Well, I guess you can, but you end up smashing your head and everybody else's into the car, head in the car. Josiah probably wished he could just slam on the brakes as hard as he could and get the fuck out of the car, but that would have killed the rest of us, and he didn't want to do that. He had to slow the car down at a reasonable pace so we didn't slam into the car in front of us. But 2 months is an awfully small amount of time to slow down a family of four that has been together in one form or another for 7 years. So it turned out that all of us ended up getting our heads slammed anyway. One of the first parts of our life that had to be dismantled was the sleeping arrangements. I simply could not sleep. When Josiah said he couldn't be in the marriage anymore, I instantly lost that part of the human condition, the ability to fall asleep. I have great parents, way above average, I would say. Like all people, we don't always see eye to eye, and it's a parent-child relationship, so it has its complications, but generally, I lucked out. And beyond my basic luck, my mother had about 10 really stellar moments. They are knockout moments that should go down in the Parenting Hall of Fame. When I was a teenager, I had a college tour of California that was also a speaking tour for my father, who was running a lefty political think tank. During the day, we would go see places like UC Santa Cruz, and at night, he would lecture about post-Reagan America. As it happened, the Grateful Dead were also playing in California, and in an amazing display of coolness, my father let me go to a weekend of shows in Ventura while he watched the Celtics-Lakers playoff game at the Santa Barbara Biltmore. Lots of my pals were going to be there, but I had no idea where they were or where I was going to stay, but my dad let me go. This was in the days of no cell phones, so for a father to let his 17-year-old daughter join the masses of deadheads walking toward the stadium to find her way for 24 hours was pretty amazing. He trusted me, and he was right to, because all I did was dance to Sugar Magnolia and sit around a beachy parking lot with a bunch of kids from Brown. I don't think I even had a beer. But I did meet and develop a crush on this blonde, slightly hippie kid named Roberto. We wandered around the... bless you. We wandered around the parking lot together, mostly talking about music and drawing. We might have made out at the show, but it was pretty innocent. When I had to leave to go find my father in Santa Barbara, he gave me this little green jade frog. That frog, I believed, led to bad luck for the next week. Little bad luck, like missing buses and ordering badly at restaurants, but I was convinced it was because of the frog. My dad and I went directly from our college speaking tour to Maine, where my mother and brother Andrew were. Almost as soon as we got to the island, I took my frog to my mother and told her my worry. When I think back on what I must have looked like, I sort of have to laugh. I was working the whole hippie thing. My hair was very blonde and long. I wore long, beady earrings and many, many silver rings on my fingers. I had faded tie-dyes and ripped jeans. I must have just looked like a sweet cliche of every teenager in the world. Anyway, I went to her very seriously with my problem. "Mom, I think this frog is bringing me bad luck," I said. She held out her hand flat for me to put the frog on and gave it a good look. "Where did you get him?" she said. "This boy Roberto gave him to me," I said, and I explained briefly what had gone on. "Huh. Well, if you really think this frog is bringing you bad luck, take him to the dock, say a proper goodbye to him, and toss him in the sea." It made all the sense to the world to her what this frog was to me. Nothing huge, but not meaningless. She didn't give me shit about who the feckless boy named Roberto was. She didn't blow me off. She just gave me good advice, which I took. I took the frog from her, went to the house, marched to the water, and walked down the dock to its edge. "Goodbye, frog. I hope the sea washes away your bad vibes and you find somebody else," I whispered. I kissed it and threw it in the drink. Years later, when my mother found herself with the same girl having really bad luck in Ohio, she sent me sleeping pills so I could get through the day. It may sound trite, but I was blown over that she even knew what a sleeping pill was, much less that she had access to this stuff. I had heard both my mother and my mother-in-law talk about not being able to sleep all the way through the night. I think it's a menopause thing. But there she was having a prescription for Ambien and no judgment about the fact that I needed it. She sent me four of them, and she instructed me to split each into three doses. I think the pills were 10 milligrams each, so what I was taking I was only taking 3 milligrams, which is about enough for an ant. But it did the job, and I was beyond grateful for them. I ended up taking Ambien every night for the next 6 months. I often credit Paul Simon and Nora Ephron for getting me through my divorce, but right up on the top of the list would also have to be the sleeping drug Ambien. I simply could not have done what I did without it. I should write to the company. You can't save your life and be exhausted at the same time. I'm so dyslexic that reading out loud is really not that fun. So always at the end, I'm like, ah. When I'd gotten back, I was in Ohio, and then I came back to live with my parents and my two boys, and then I met and married my husband, and there was a real moment of sort of calm. It's like just a placid moment. Suddenly my kids were in school. I wasn't in save your life mode, and I thought, and this story had been kind of building in me. And because I'm an actress, the process of storytelling is something that's sort of second nature to me. So when there was this pause, there goes my best friend, who's in the book. Do you know, guys know The Locket? Did you ever read it? The one who gives me the locket? There she is. So suddenly, because I had this big story, sort of like an egg in me, and this pause, it just came out. And then I actually started writing it on my BlackBerry, and in children's classes, you know, I was sort of like, maybe it just sort of started coming out. And then suddenly, I thought that's crazy. I should go and write it. And then I knew about this place because my ex-husband wrote his dissertation here, and so I thought I'll just. No, and it's really funny. I think I must have some kind of, I don't know if you read the book, but there's a part about, and it's a tiny part about a coffee shop guy. It's like when your life is falling apart, you kind of get used to it, but other people are taken aback by it. And so if I burst into tears in front of the coffee shop guy, I'm like, oh, well, you know, right? I'd fall apart every other minute. So the coffee shop guy's really freaked out. And the coffee shop guy wrote me. It's like, oh, I remember that. That did freak me out. But I can remember what I ate in 1983. I don't know what it is. I just seem to grasp onto details and I just don't forget them.
Can you explain the reference to Paul Simon and Nora Ephron?
Oh, yes. Paul Simon, I just love. And he is very kid-friendly. Kids like him, too. And so... when I was back in New York and suffering and winter and babies and I would put on Graceland, and he has lots of talk about in his songs about divorce and love and everything. And he even has this thing about when you get divorced, you lose a lot of weight, which is true. So I found his music very uplifting and very, it carried me through. And sometimes I just put it on and literally just dance to get myself through a bad moment. And Nora Ephron, I loved Heartburn, was a big inspiration for me. I just love her too, and so I had seen Heartburn when I was about 14, and when this happened, I was like, oh, maybe I better watch that movie again. So just her work, but not personally. I don't know them. No. I never thought I was going to write because I really am very, I think I went to Brearley and Nightingale, and I honestly think those English teachers are like, what? she did what? I think, and my agent and editor think it's almost charming how badly I spell. I mean, I really can't spell. So they'll get the manuscript and, you know, pale and pale, you know, I just don't know which one is which, and spell check doesn't get it, and that I didn't think I could write, but I knew I could. Again, the acting, because I'd been acting for so long, and the process of getting what's inside out is something that not only have I been interested in, but it's what I did for 20 years. So the process is very similar. And the shocking thing is that I love writing. I didn't give myself any credit that I would, or that I would like to spend that much time by myself. But now I find that if I'm not writing, I feel lonely. Isn't that a weird feeling? I think that's so bizarre. But I sort of will wander around the street and go, what's missing? And I'm like, oh, I'm not writing. Which is just such a, as you near 40, it's such a, I don't like the word gift, but it is. It does feel like some sort of present that someone has said, God or whoever has said, here, do that for the next 4 years, you know, or 50. So yeah, shocking but fun. Julia Child didn't cook an omelet till she was 43. Right, and we have the same editor, so or we did. No, I actually didn't tell anybody I was doing it. I told my husband, and I actually told my ex-husband too. I said to my husband, I'm writing about my life, and it's going to be a lot about my ex-husband's name is DeSales, and if that bothers you at all, if you have any problem with that at all, I have no problem with telling really the truth about what happened in my life. So, but if it bothered him, I would stop tomorrow. I mean, I really would, because it's just not worth it to me. Now, I don't know. Now, maybe I wouldn't stop. But I had, no, I didn't tell anybody. I didn't, you know, and if I did tell someone, people were like, oh, well, good for you for trying to do that. And then I've gotten, so, you know, when I sold the book, people were like, you know. But, you know, I lived, DeSales is an incredibly good writer. And he always said when he, you know, my letters and stuff, he was like, you're a good writer. You know, he told me. So it was like a little whisper, but no, I never.
How did you jump from that to the
It's a big leap. I, on the first day that I came here to write the book, and I told the librarian downstairs, I was like, I'm joining because I'm going to write a book. They were like, well, okay, lots of people do. So here you go. And I had lunch with a friend of mine, Eliza Griswold, who is a very, very good writer. And but she's a friend. She was married to my friend. She got divorced. Blah, blah. And we had lunch at Mellon's. And I said, you know what I'm doing today? I'm going to write a book. And she said, oh, she's so generous and sweet. And she was like, oh, well, you should send it to my agent. And I was like, dude, I just started today. I don't have anything to send, and I don't think I will, and who knows? And she was like, well, I bet it's going to be good, and when you're ready, I'll just tell him your name. So I remember I finished the book, and I went to the stairwell. People ask me if it's cathartic, and I always say, no, 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 it's not cathartic. It wasn't about, I was fine, I didn't need a catharsis. And I went to the stairwell and cried my eyes out. And but that day I got back on the bus, and I had his email, and I was like, okay, so. And I had printed it. It took me hours at Kinko's. And he said, like, oh, fine, you know, because Eliza's a good friend and his client. Like, send me some pages. And I didn't know what he meant. So I just sent him, like, oh, I like what I said on 94. I'll send him that. And 123 looks good. I'll send him that. And, you know, I just sent him, like, 11 random pages. And he called me. He was like, hi. I don't even know what to say to you. He said, I'm very interested in what you've sent me. I have no idea what it's about. So could you actually send me the entire thing? He said, your writing, though, is very gripping. So send it to me. So I sent it to him. And the next week we met, and he said, this is a book, which surprised me. And then he corrected the spelling with me. And we put it in a little package and sent it to 10 publishers. And then there was an auction. The next week or something, 2 weeks later. So, you know, a little bit not what it's, I don't think it's usually like that. But But I will say that I think that many years of kind of, because it was sort of 2 years after that, many years of forming the story, it really was a story. And I think that's, I don't know, but that's how it happened.
How long did you spend
there? About 3 months, 4 months. But I went every day. I wrote every day. I'd drop my kids off from school and go and write from 10 till 2 and have a sandwich at Gentile. But it was kind of like, you know when you just get an idea about something and you just chase it down? And that's just what it felt like. And I'm pretty disappointed, very spastic and blah, but really, if I want to, I can get something done. So. Oh, hi, Ben. Well, it's interesting. I mean, there's two. The book have suffered if I wasn't so clear about who everybody was? And actually, it's true. The only two people in the book that are disguised are my ex-husband and his wife. And you know, I could have changed the town. I could have changed the college. And you know, if I did it again, I don't know if I would have. It caused them a lot of pain, and which I. You know, I sort of feel two ways about it. I feel like everybody's allowed to write about their life, but you don't want anybody that you love. And I love my ex-husband in some way, you know, and like as a friend and as the father of my children. And I actually, funny enough, I'm good friends with his wife now, too. So, like, if when they get hate letters from people, you know, kind of like edging towards death, hate letters, you know, like how dare, you know, like kind of very feeling very sort of family values-ish kind of letters. That's a bummer, and that's been hard. But on the other hand, you know, if they didn't do what they did, I'd still be in Ohio putting mums on my doorstep and not writing a book in New York. So I don't know, you know. And as far as my parents are concerned, they read it and. I think as far as people connecting to it, the more truthful you are, the better. And this felt truthful to me. So maybe that's why people connected.
Did you write what you would consider a first draft?
I would go back. I'd go back in the morning of the next day and read it and hear it and tweak it, and I'm a tweaker, so I could tweak something. I could tweak something right now in here. I would tweak it, and then when it felt kind of done, like you know about a chicken or something like that in the oven, then I'd move on. And I knew exactly what I was going to write, so I'd be like, okay, now I have to write the part about X, Y, Z, and so I'd tweak and then just keep going. I do, you know, I don't know, gift, but you know, it's what happened in their life. And I think by the time that they're able to read, they're dyslexic too, so that'll take them a little longer. But by the time they're able to read it, they'll know this story from so many different angles and told from so many different points of view, and their father will tell it to them, and I'll tell it to them, and we're dedicated to helping them through it, so it's for the boys. It's for them. I think Maury Sendak. I think I'm seeing this. Said, tell your children anything as long as it's the truth. And I think that's kind of how I see it. And if they're mad, I'll sit there with them and talk them through that. You know, I don't know. I don't know really, but I think they'll appreciate that I did it. And I wrote it with love. I really did. I wrote it with everybody. I don't think that there's. And the next book is very much about, you know, how I contributed to, and everybody contributed. I think that we all are so multi-dimensional, and we all have good and bad and medium, and, you know, I can say the meanest things I ever heard anybody say come out of my mouth, and that's not good. So, you know, I feel like I didn't ever put a halo on my head, and they'll know that, you know, I hope. You know, that's so interesting. That is a very literary screenplay. I mean, it reads like a novel, and it has so many, you know, Jane Austen and all that wonderful stuff in it, and Witt's such a good writer. I think I've been very lucky in my life to be surrounded by a lot of good writing because of education and because my parents were big readers, and even just the places where, you know, I dwell, there's, you know, writers everywhere, and maybe it just sunk in somewhere and I didn't know it, you know? Yeah, I'm certainly not a highbrow, you know, reader so much, but yeah, I think probably, you know, your life informs your whatever comes out of you, so probably it did. My ex-husband he's very smart and very literary and gets it about writing. You know, he was like, hey, this is painful. He never said, ooh, good job, you know. But he just, you know, it's probably not done yet, whatever the experience is for him. And, but miraculously, we've been able to move, just keep going, and we really are focused on the boys. So, you know, I just had lunch with the two of them at Hummus Place last Friday, you know, like 2 weeks ago. The three of us, they were coming to visit the boys, and I ran into them on the street before the weekend sort of started, and I was hungry, they were hungry, let's go to Hummus Place, okay, we all sit down. I mean, you know, it's kind of like you got to just keep moving along. Even when your ex-wife writes the book in Starbucks, you know, that couldn't have been easy. But and my current husband is adorable, and he loves it, you know, and he's completely supportive. And although I couldn't ever have him write about his old loves, and you know, it's definitely not a what's that thing of a what? No, yeah, and not fair and. I don't even want to hear, you know, where they got married, you know. So, but he's fantastic.
Can you tell us about the next book and if the writing and the reception to your first book is going to change how you write the next one and what the next one will be about?
The next one, which I'm writing here, which is fun, is has been just a pleasure to write too. It's funny because it's not done, and I don't really know what it is yet. I mean, it's done, but it's going to have to change and morph more. I think what's interesting about that is that once you start, it is kind of like Julia Child. Once you start doing something, maybe it's even halfway through your life. I just like the process, so I don't even know how it's gonna, if it's gonna be sold even. I don't even know, but I don't really care because then I wrote an article for Gourmet, which it's not gonna be in Gourmet because it closed, which is so depressing. And I wrote an article for Slate, and it's just sort of fun. It's like someone gave me a new coat and I get to wear it all the time. I mean, it's been, the writing part is really a thrill, and I don't know what it's gonna, I don't know what. You know, I never understand about sales or anything like that, but And I forgot the other part of your question. Is that? Oh, no, I'm not nearly famous enough. I would, like, be the, you know, the person who goes in the little cameo of the waitress or something. But, no, it's been optioned, and it's in their hands now. But it's hard. I mean, I think it's impossible to make a movie right now. So if the stars aligned and everything. But I think it could be. I think it's very sort of cinematic. And it wouldn't cost that much, I don't think, to make. But there are no spaceships or anything. But, written? I don't know. I was teaching acting, and I loved teaching. So that might have, you know, I think it's sort of, and it's maybe women, men, whatever, this time of life, it's, I mean, I couldn't have kept continued teaching because I couldn't teach at Oberlin, and, you know, it's different in New York. But I something was going to change, whether it was my occupation. If it was going to be teaching or writing or starting a flower, I thought I was going to start a flower business out there. I didn't know. But, you know, it just, that I think it's interesting, the sort of shift from young, from child, young adult, babies, and then 40, whoop, flip, and then what am I going to do next? It's sort of fascinating to me. I don't know.
I went to Oberlin College.
You never told me that? No. You know what's so funny? I think you're right. I actually think that if had he been at Columbia and I was teaching at NYU or something, or even if I was teaching at Columbia, you know, we were, I mean, literally my office was here and his was there. I mean, it was across the path. So I think it was because we were so close and knew everybody and they were there in the office together because their offices were right. But if I was all the way downtown, I would never have gone to see if he wanted a cup of tea in the middle of the day. You know, that just doesn't happen. And so I think it was all expedient. I think it had a lot to do with the fact we were so close. And you really can't do anything in a tiny little town, especially a college town, without it being very public. And I don't hate Oberlin at all. Love Oberlin. It is a marvelous place, and I hope that the book only did good things for Oberlin. You know, I mean, it's a wonderful place and filled with great people. I love Oberlin.
What helped you if you wrote the book later on? What helped you move on from your experience?
Well, that's a lot what the second book is about. But a lot was these little babies that I had and just having not being able to wallow and having this real feeling of, wow, you really do only live once, and I can either get mad and bitter and bummed out about this, or I can kind of just do that good old waspy thing and pull up my socks and, you know, make breakfast or, you know, take the kids to school. And once you start living and, you know, friends, I think I told you maybe in the book about the radicchio leaf, like I remember cooking and looking at a radicchio leaf and being like, that is so pretty. Look, Isabel, at how pretty that is. And life is so much bigger than you. And something made that radicchio leaf and, you know, just getting a bigger perspective. And my father every 5 minutes telling me it wasn't a rack. which, honestly, you know, Dad would be like, that's terrible, but it's not a wreck. I was like, you're right, you know. And, you know, will to live. It's, you know, in Titanic, and he's dead at the end. Sorry if you didn't see the movie, but the Titanic, right? Someone has to die. So he is dead, and she's clutching onto him, and he goes into the sea, and she's really about to die herself. She's so cold, and her love just died and fell into the ocean, and why live, really? You're in the middle of the ocean, and it's freezing, and you're on the Titanic. But she has this moment of being like, actually? And she looks around and sees the other dead police guy and swims over and grabs his whistle and blows and blows and blows. And I think that's a very human instinct to want to keep going and, you know, meet Peter and have fun and, you know, do stuff like that. So I think it's all people can do it. And you just have to kind of know where to look or what to believe. I don't know. Just keep going.
Knowing you and your family has all different books with a wonderful understanding and without accusation, which means that we didn't bring that up, which is lovely. Just another writing question in terms of editing and revision. Did, for example, the chapter structure, was that there from the beginning?
No. It was just one big long chapter, and and my agent said, FYI, you gotta make chapters. So whenever you just go to the library, I remember specifically where I was sitting when I did this, and I just read it, and every time there was kind of a little pause or there was a particularly good sentence at the end, I'd just say chapter two, you know, and I just went through the whole thing.
Yeah.
And there are a million of them. I mean, they're really... In the next one, maybe they'll have some longer chapters, but that came before I sent it to the editors. That was my agent telling me to do that.
And it was your instinct
to pace it. Oh, yeah, I chaptered it up, but it wasn't like I did it before, I did it after.
And would that have been a major point of revision?
Then nothing got moved around. They did, Nan said, give me one more Gillies thing. And I wrote a chapter about in Maine about the listening to the motorboats, and so that was after. And the last chapter was after. It ended in the airport, and I wrote the last.
Time for one more question.
Of looking out into the tree and having that vision about the, that's interesting. I think it actually, that window was very, because it is the whole, you know, it's this incredibly rent-controlled, it sounds really fancy, but it's really not. But that window really was, because it was so much life. There was the whole park, the whole dog walkers, the everything, and then all of Fifth Avenue, and then all of, you know, Queens, and it did have a sort of perspective element to it. And so much of it was winter. And also, I think, oddly, and I'm not religious, so I don't know why the Bible always comes, but I think that thing of winter and death and stillness and being like, it is going to grow. Not going to grow right this second, but spring does come, and it will grow, you know. So just wait, but then pounce. Thank you for coming.
We have copies of the book, and Isabel will be at the front if you would like her to sign one. Thanks for coming, and remember to pick up a card if you'd like to get our email updates. Thank you.